Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington, working on this program via remote. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Friday, April 15, 2022. The UN World Food Program suspends operation in South Sudan's Leer County.
The most urgent issue to resolve is, of course, the violence. If the violence stops, if people can be safe and our operations can restart safely, then we can do something about people's immediate needs, and we can also, in the longer term, help them get back on their feet.
And a newspaper in the South Sudanese capital, Juba, defies court orders to cease publication.
They want to establish and prove that the newspaper belongs to their left hand. The name Juba Monitor belongs to Alfred Tamanda, and therefore the family has heirs. They have every right to say to you that the legacy of their father continues.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The UN World Food Program says it has suspended operations in Leer County of South Sudan's Unity State following recent clashes in the area. WFP's country representative for South Sudan says the decision was taken after WFP warehouses were looted and vandalized by armed groups. For VOA News, Dengai Deng reports from Juba.
The country representative of the World Food Program in South Sudan, Matthew Hollingworth, says the WFP has suspended its operations in Leer County due to fighting that reportedly took place between the SPLA-IO faction loyal to First Vice President Riek Machar and SPLA-IO faction loyal to Simon Gadwich. Hollingworth says WAP 4 warehouses in Tonyor, Tindir and Adokport were looted and destroyed.
We've seen food commodities that are in humanitarian warehousing facilities destroyed or stolen, the warehouses destroyed, different items of humanitarian materials looted, all of which is going to mean that what is already a very difficult year to bring resources to support the people of South Sudan is going to get even harder for us. Obviously, it's horrific what we've seen happening to people. There have been people killed, injured.
Hollingworth says at least 25,000 people have been displaced because of fighting in Unity State. Hollingworth says the WAP is still assessing its losses, but more importantly, the tens of thousands of people who were displaced will miss out on relief food.
Many humanitarians have had to be relocated out of the area because the violence is ongoing. We've also lost commodities that have been burned or stolen, and so we're going to have to replace them, which takes some time. And we also need to really identify where people have gone. Right now we know there's a lot of people hiding for their lives in the bush. So when we identify where they are, then we can mount a response, not just the World Food Program, but across the humanitarian community.
The WAP says at least 140 humanitarian staff who were working in Leer County have been evacuated for safety to their homes based in the area. Hollingworth says thousands of people could be in dire need of humanitarian aid, but the WAP will not be able to do any assistance until the security situation improves in the area. He is urging the South Sudanese government to quickly intervene and end the fighting so people can return and rebuild their lives.
The most urgent issue to resolve is, of course, the violence. If the violence stops, if people can be safe and our operations can restart safely, then we can do something about people's immediate needs, and we can also, in the longer term, help them get back on their feet. But that doesn't happen without the leadership of the country at the national level, at the state level, at the PIAM level, from getting involved to ensure that the violence ends immediately.
This week, President Salva Kiir formed a committee headed by Water Resources Minister Manawa Peter to investigate the insecurity in Leer after several villages in the county were recently looted and burned, and more than 30 people killed. For VOA News, I am Deng Gaiding in Juba.
The editor of one of South Sudan's oldest English dailies, the Juba Monitor, says the newspaper is operating despite a court order issued earlier this week to shut down operations. A lawyer representing the family of the owner of the newspaper says the family sued the paper's publisher, Grand African Media, over what he calls a management dispute. For VOA News, Manyang, David Mayar reports from Juba.
On Tuesday, Juba's Katura High Court ordered the Juba Monitor to close. The paper is owned by Grand Africa Media Service, and late veteran journalist Alfred Taban was one of its founding members and a major shareholder in the company. The Monitor was established in Juba in 2011 after South Sudan seceded from the rest of Sudan. Bechu Pitialagu, the lawyer representing the Alfred Taban family, says the court order follows a long-time dispute between the family and the management.
They want to establish and prove that the newspaper belongs to their late father. The name Juba Monitor belongs to Alfred Taban, and therefore the family has heirs. They have every right to seem to it that the legacy of their father continues very well and in a proper and dignified manner.
In an order seen by South Sudan in Focus, the court froze all bank accounts of the newspaper. PTR says the Taban family resorted to litigation after several failed attempts to resolve the dispute peacefully. Despite the court order, management continues to print and circulate copies of the Juba Monitor on the streets of the capital. Anne Amriano, editor-in-chief of the Juba Monitor, says the court order has not reached her desk.
I did not receive any order that Juba Monitor is closed. That is why yesterday we published the newspaper and today we published also.
Namriano confirms the dispute has lingered between the paper's management and the Taban's family. She says when Taban died, management allowed Alfred Taban's children to take over ownership of their father's shares in the company. Taban worked as a correspondent in Sudan for the BBC and Reuters and later became a member of parliament in the South Sudan's Transitional National Legislative Assembly. He died at the age of 62 in the Ugandan capital Kampala from an unknown disease. Namriano says Taban's legacy is intertwined with the history of the Juba Monitor.
If it is closed, now Juba Monitor is not there. It is like even nobody can remember him for us. To move Juba Monitor ahead, it is like Alfred is still living. So now even Juba Monitor is closed, it means everything is died.
Namriano says a lawyer representing Grand Africa Media Service is appealing the court order in an attempt to keep the paper running. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayar in Juba.
The Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition says President Salva Kiir violated a deal reached between the SPLM in government, the SPLM in opposition, and the South Sudan Opposition Alliance when he appointed officers to the Unified Command. The SPLM IO military spokesperson alleges that Mr. Kiir created additional positions in the army and police for his top military officers. Wake Simon Wudu has more for VOA from Juba.
SPLIO spokesperson Colonel Lampol Gabriel says the positions President Kiir created were not agreed to by the parties on the unification of the command structure. He says SPLIO learned during Kiir's broadcast order that he added three new posts in the army, five in the national police, and two new posts in the national security service.
There was the creation of Deputy Director General for Administration and Finance in Internal Security Bureau, and also one position also for Deputy Director General for Admin and Finance in the External Security Bureau. These were not agreed for, and not even signed during the Secretary-General Agreement. Then the Army, what was there were about 12 positions, but we noticed that there was creation of the Assistant CDF for Procurement, which was supposed to be in the Ministry of Defense, not in the General Headquarters.
Gabriel says Kiir appointed senior military officers from his party into the newly created positions, violating the security deal and the percentage ratio agreed to by the parties. He says the latest ratio is now 70-30 for the SPLM in government and the opposition respectively. Brigadier Ibrahim Semir David, the spokesperson of the South Sudan Opposition Alliance, says the new positions were not part of those the parties agreed to in the command structure that was signed around 2 weeks ago. He says it's a concern that will be addressed by the principals of the parties. He says it's a concern that will be addressed by the principals of the parties.
This thing will be addressed in presidency. We are in JDB. This case is above 4 hours. These things will be addressed there, the presidency meeting.
Major General Lul Roy Kwong, the South Sudan People's Defense Force spokesperson, denies the president created new positions.
It was more or less upgrading. For instance, the military economic cooperation was headed by a major general, and his designation was Director General for Military Economic Cooperation. Now, the person that was made the head now was an officer at the rank of Lieutenant General, and he was reassigned as Assistant East for Military Production. That unit existed ever since. Then, Director of Procurement falls under the Minister of Defense and Veteran Affairs. It was headed by an officer at the rank of Major General, and that officer was being called the Director General for Procurement. What was done was, now a Lieutenant General was reassigned to be the Director General for Procurement, so that unit also existed.
Kwong says some of the developments during the announcement of the presidential order are nothing new, and insists there is no creation of new positions. Colonel Gabriel says the newly created posts are what he calls technically a violation of the agreement, but believes the matter can be sorted out through dialogue. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Some Sudanese political parties are expressing mixed reaction over a Sudanese court ruling to release members of former President Omar al-Bashir's government who have been in jail for 2 years. A member of the Sudanese Congress Party criticized the move, calling it part of the military government's propaganda. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Khartoum.
On Thursday, a Sudanese court ordered the immediate release of 8 members of the banned National Congress Party who were detained since June 2020. The former officials were accused of overthrowing a democratic government when Bashir led a revolt that overthrew the elected government in 1989. The presiding judge says the court could not find enough evidence to charge the individuals. Speaking to South Sudan in Focus in Khartoum, Mubarak al-Fadil, the leader of Umma Party, welcomes the decision, saying the arrests were politically motivated. He accuses the Forces for Freedom and Change Coalition, or FFC, of breaking the law.
They have frozen the constitutional court, and they have left many judicial organs unmanned. So they did so in order to take the law into their hands.
Last week, the same court released 13 members of the NCP, including the former Sudanese Foreign Minister Professor Ibrahim Gandour. Nuruddin Salahuddin of the Sudanese Congress Party and a member of the political bureau of the FFC criticized the ruling and accused the country's military leaders of desperately seeking a new political support.
After nearly 6 months of a failed management of the country, after they have realized that they don't have a proper political program for the country, and after losing the political ground among Sudanese people, they don't have any choice rather than invoking the Islamist support to lead them in the coming period.
Salahuddin says the ruling is a clear indication that the Islamists are back in power. But Al-Fadil says he did not see it that way.
They have been dispersed. They have no leadership. They are hated amongst the Sudanese people. And I don't see that they have any chance of coming to power in the coming 10 or 20 years.
Speaking to this program by phone in Khartoum last week, As-Sanusi Ahmad, a defense lawyer for Gandour and his colleagues, says the defendants were freed because the court could not find any concrete evidence that would lead to a conviction. The 20 members of the NCP who were freed were also charged with inciting violence against a constitutional system and financing terrorism. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. The extent of damage from floods in South Africa's KwaZulu-Natal province is coming into sharp focus. More than 340 people have died and thousands have lost their homes. Journalist Marion Naker in Durban spoke with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson about the disaster a short while ago.
Prior to the floods, essential services were already at a strain. Certain areas within the province had gone weeks without water, without electricity, and it was something that government and authorities were trying to get a hold of. The floods then took things to a completely different level because it then damaged serious infrastructure, and not just infrastructure and piping along the way, but pump stations and electricity substations. What it's done is it's created an outage now that's lasted in some areas for more than a week.
We also have seen the roads and bridges being very badly damaged. How is that affecting efforts to restore water or to even bring in water tankers to communities and to restore electricity?
What has happened is the major bridges and entrances into communities have collapsed. So alternate routes are being made available and being used. But what that does mean is that regular traffic that would commute on a national highway are also using alternative routes as a means to get back home or to get to work or to just go down to the grocery store and get simple supplies. So that's caused a major backlog. What authorities have done is they've prioritized the national highways. The national highways were closed for almost 2 days. And what we know is that the highway which connects KwaZulu-Natal to Johannesburg and to other parts of the country carry cargo, carry goods. So it's imperative that, you know, they were reopened and they were worked on.
Compounding all of this, I understand, is the damage to the port at Durban. How is that affecting things?
So the Durban port is the biggest port in the sub-Saharan African region. It brings across fuel, it brings across food and supplies, not just to the province of KwaZulu-Natal, but a network that then drives it around the country and into SADC nations like Zimbabwe, like Namibia, like Angola. The immediate problem into the port is that the roads coming out of the port are hugely problematic. And while authorities are trying to get those roads sorted out, there's a backlog of trucks trying to get into the port and a backlog of trucks trying to get out of the port.
That's journalist Marion Naker in Durban. He was speaking with my colleague Kate Pound Dawson. South Sudanese health officials are preparing to roll out HIV self-testing kits to help more people know their status in the country. But some men in the capital, Juba, have concerns and are reluctant to take the test. Sheila Pony reports for VOA from Juba.
Moro Lawrence, Deputy Director for Surveillance and Research in South Sudan's Health Ministry, says many South Sudanese men have no idea what their HIV status is and don't want to know.
Men do not come to the health facilities for HIV testing because they say they are busy and yet they are the one passing on the virus. Most men believe that when their wives are pregnant, whenever they get for the NC visit and they get tested and if found negative, they take that result, that negative results that was found on the wife. They take it also for them. They believe that because their wives are negative, they're also negative. But yet they don't know that the wife might be negative, but due to they're still at the window period.
Lauren says the wife may have tested throughout the window period, but the husband may already have contracted HIV. He says the fact that too few men know their HIV status means many either come too late for treatment or risk passing the HIV virus on. Several people on the streets of Juba told South Sudan in Focus men avoid taking HIV tests because they are terrified of dying if the results are positive. Juba resident Charles Soro calls it fear of the unknown.
You never know the status of that particular lady you've gone with, and it's a big fear to get positive results. You know, one feels very difficult to take it, and sometimes people can even resort into frustrations.
Another Juba resident, Data Godon, says men fear going for HIV testing because of the fear, the stigma attached to being HIV positive.
We all know the impact of masculinity, especially negative masculinity. Culturally, men have multiple sexual partners, which results to polygamy, and that means they have unprotected sex, and that is where the fear comes in, because HIV is also sexually transmitted, and that is an impact that also brings in the aspect of fear, shame, and of course lack of action when it talks about HIV testing, especially on men.
Juba resident Peter Garang says many men shun the HIV test because they don't understand the virus.
I will actually allude all this to lack of adequate awareness, you know, so that men can really see that it's actually equally important to go for HIV testing. So there has been no adequate male involvement.
Lawrence says HIV cases diagnosed in some parts of the country have reached an all-time high, prompting the health ministry to roll out self-testing kits, which are designed to encourage people to get tested.
We look at self-testing as a supplementary testing because the current prevalence rates that we have in the country are still so high.
Juba resident Nelson Mandela welcomes the self-testing kits, but says the rollout should be coupled with more public information about HIV.
It is a good idea, but I think also more awareness need to be, our people need to be educated. More awareness need to be given out so that people can learn to accept whatever result that comes out. Because even if we have the self-testing kit and then someone is still having the fear of testing himself, trust me, that person is just going to pick the kit and then keep it at home. So more awareness needs to be done.
The Ministry of Health is making HIV self-testing kits available through public and private health facilities and selected pharmacies for free. The latest data puts the HIV prevalence in South Sudan at 2.2%. According to the UNAIDS 2020 report, there is worry about the increasing trend in the number of new HIV infections, with one in every four people living with HIV knowing their HIV status. For VOA News, I am Sheila Pony in Juba.
We love to hear your remarks about our news in this broadcast. My colleague Nabil Biagio is ready with this week's listener comments. Over to you, Nabil.
Thank you, John. This week, we heard from several of you about our news coverage on the deadly fighting in the disputed region of Abyei, such as Daniel Duddagbai from Ragmajok in Lake State, who says, even if millions of committees are formed to investigate the Miseria attack on the Ngok Dinka in the disputed area of Abyei and there is no unity within the South Sudanese government, then the attacks will never end. The national government needs to implement the revitalized peace agreements such that external attacks are addressed by all South Sudanese people. May their souls rest in eternal peace. Mading Malwal Alwong from Malakal Town says, Abyei is a part of South Sudan, and any aggression must be quickly condemned. And most importantly, if the United Nations Interim Security Force for Abyei has failed to protect the civilians and cannot allow fleeing citizens of Abyei to take refuge in its camp from the Miseria attack, then what is their mandate? South Sudan must quickly scrutinize the purpose of the UN forces in Abyei. Samuel Ramon in Yei writes, Hi John Tanza and Nabil Biagio. If South Sudanese citizens who had sacrificed their lives because of this country would wake up to be alive and see what is going on in the country, they would regret the mistakes they have made. I am appealing to our leaders to give peace a chance. Nyakom Garkwath from Khartoum says, "Hi VOA John and Nabil. I am not happy because of the fighting in the south of Unity State, especially in Leer County. The burning down of villages by three commissioners loyal to the government. The killing of innocent civilians and taking their belongings." Natalie Kazito Nguya from Yambio Health Sciences Institute writes, "Hello John Tanza, it's really bad to always listen to the displacement of our people. When will this come to an end? We are really tired. We want peace in our country. Let our politicians stop this useless war." Bantor Kwangai in the Juba POC site says, "Mr. Taker Riak does not want to tell the truth about the incident that resulted in the fighting which displaced hundreds of civilians in Leer. He is among those who carried out the attack. If he doesn't participate in those activities, how come the two commissioners united themselves and attacked his county without reacting to that?" The opinions heard here do not reflect the views of VOA or of this program. Thanks for all of your comments and keep them coming.
Keep your comments brief and we will air them every Friday. Our WhatsApp number is +1 202 630 8011.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For a year, Iran and the United States have been in negotiations aimed at a mutual return to compliance with the Iran nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA, formerly the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The United States withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018 under the previous administration, and Iran has been breaching its obligations under the deal since then, including by enriching uranium to prohibited levels and producing uranium metal, which, as Germany, Britain, and France have said, has no credible civilian use. Significant progress has been made during the negotiations between Iran and the P5+1 countries for a U.S.-Iran return to the JCPOA. U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley, recently said, however, that a return to the deal is not inevitable because of unresolved issues that are important to both countries. During a recent visit to Israel, Secretary of State Antony Blinken reiterated the United States' view that a full implementation of the JCPOA is the best way to put Iran's nuclear program back in the box. But, Secretary Blinken emphasized, whether there's a JCPOA or not, our commitment to the core principle of Iran never acquiring a nuclear weapon is unwavering. Secretary Blinken noted that Iran's malign activities in the region have intensified. The United States will continue to stand up to Iran when it threatens us or when it threatens our allies and partners, he said, and will continue to work to counter its aggressive behavior throughout the region. In line with that commitment, on March 30th, the United States announced it was designating five individuals and entities for sanctions because of their involvement in Iran's ballistic missile-related activities, including Iran's recent missile attack on Erbil, Iraq, as well as missile attacks by Iranian proxies against Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Brian E. Nelson, Undersecretary of the Treasury for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence, said in a statement announcing the sanctions, "While the United States continues to seek Iran's return to full compliance with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, we will not hesitate to target those who support Iran's ballistic missile program. We will also work with other partners in the region to hold Iran accountable for its actions, including gross violations of the sovereignty of its neighbors."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
That's all we prepared for you this Friday. We now end this show with Victoria Ole and the song Yala Kitautu.
Yala Kitautu.
Yala
Kitautu.
Yala Yala.
Yala Kitautu.
Yala
Kitautu.
We have been listening to Victoria Ole and the song Yala Kitautu. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for spending your time with us this evening. Join us next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.